This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome, All Souls fans. We are back. It is episode 13.
Ooh, lucky 13.
I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
And I think we may have someone here visiting us again.
Hi, that's Candida, and I'm very excited. This is my first All Souls podcast.
Yay. You didn't join us? You didn't join us before a year ago?
This is my first time.
I forget. No,
because they haven't had sex yet.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. I forgot. Candida is the sex maniacist.
No,
Candida
is the on purpose sex maniacist. Mandy is the on accident sex maniacist. It's so funny. Oh my goodness, you guys kill me. It's awesome. Okay,
I love a good sex scene.
Didn't you just get that? I just said we just expressed it. Okay, So this is chapter 12, and what's very hard for me, and I'll just say it. So many of you know we have another podcast, the Outlander podcast, and in Outlander, as many books, but we're most familiar with that because we've done over almost 200 episodes of it. When we do our read-alongs, we say chapter number, and then we get the chapter title. And in Deb's books, at least in this series, there are no titles. So whenever I start to say, it's chapter 12, and then I have to stop it, I'm like disappointed that, oh, but it stops.
We should just come up with our own names.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because don't you come up with names for your podcast. So, you know, that's kind of the same thing.
For the titles of the episodes,
sure. Yeah,
for the episode titles, but not for the chapters. Those come from after the episode and something funny or taboo.
The name of this chapter, if it had a name, would be Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Or Don't Feed the Wolves.
Or...
the wolves.
Or
nuts. Nuts.
Just nuts.
Nuts.
With an exclamation point.
There's a lot. But that's the thing. There's so much. And that's what we just had a little banter, like pre-show banter. Maybe we should like offer that somehow, somewhere, someday. Not this episode's pre-show banter, but in general. We had a little pre-show banter before we started recording. And I had made the comment that, oh my gosh, this chapter. And I think if you go back and listen to episodes like between like three or any of the ones we've done with episode discussions thus far for A Discovery of Witches in this podcast, I'm sure I said it more than once that, oh my gosh, this chapter was so information dense. Oh my gosh, this chapter is so information dense. One more time. Oh my God. So yeah, I said that about this one, and I'm like, because I try and take notes, right? I try and say, okay.
Try? Duh-uh. You don't try. There's no try. There's only do.
Well, as much as I appreciate all the information and the moving the story along, this is one of my favorite chapters. They're sharing information. So they're starting to trust each other and they're starting to tell each other what they know. But of course, my favorite thing of the whole chapter is just there's so much discussion of senses with the smell and the look of the food and the taste of the food. And not so much the feel of it, but a little bit of that. So it's just such a beautifully written visual chapter that I eat it up, which is perfect thing to say for this chapter because it's all about food and wine. And I'm sure you have both seen Highlander, the movie, right?
The original one?
No. There's only one movie. Well, yes, the first movie. I guess they made sequels to it. But the first one, okay.
Christoph Lambert or that dude.
Have you ever seen it? Either of you ever seen it?
Yes, okay. I have.
Sean Connery. This chapter always makes me think of the scene where Christopher Lambert's character, I'm butchering his name, comes to Roxanne Dawson's apartment with that bottle of wine. And mm-hmm. he takes the cork off and he's describing and he's telling her what year it was bottled, and 1783 or something like that. I can't remember what it was. And he says 1783 was a very good year and the Wright brothers flew, and he's going in this discussion and she's just standing there like, yeah, whatever, let's drink the wine. But, you know, he's reliving it the way Matthew relives things when he opens his bottle of wine. So I the whole time I was reading this chapter, I always go back to that scene in Highlander because I loved it, which is probably part of the reason I love this chapter, because I, you know, they're connected.
Did you see, have either of you seen the movie French Kiss?
No.
Oh, sure. With, I have not. What's his name?
You've not? Billy oh, my Crystal, God. Kevin Kline.
No,
no.
Billy Crystal. Oh, okay.
No. French Kiss is it's Meg Ryan and Kevin Kline.
Okay.
And he plays a French guy with a really questionable accent. Anyway, he plays a French guy. His name is Luc. And he has a scene kind of like that, because his whole thing, he's this thief who steals this, who illegally brings this grapevine into mm-hmm. the country. And because he wants to grow a vineyard, and his whole family grew up with wine, and he takes her to his family's like farm, and he takes her to this room, and he has this box, and in this box is all of the different things that are grown around there. And he's like, the wine tells a story, and he kind of has her smell the different things in the box. And then she takes a sip of the wine, and he's like, now what do you taste? And then she was able to pick the things that were growing in the ground. So it was kind of like kind of the same thing, but a little different. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny because I don't drink. So I'm not able to appreciate wine because I don't like the taste of anything. But yet I love reading about people who do appreciate it. And I think the other thing that's kind of happening in this chapter, at least from my perspective, is we're kind of time traveling here through Matthew's memories, which is also, you know, because we're all time travel fans, which is also fun. So anyway, I guess we should talk about the chapter, right?
I'm sure Ginger's gnashing at the bit.
Yeah.
Not at all. What I was trying to say was not to not let you finish, but all I was saying is it's so information dense that I took so many, probably more than I needed to. I took so many notes that even if you wanted to, there is no rushing through this chapter because there's so much to say.
Oh, it's a great chapter. It's a great chapter. Yeah.
So Diana is off to prep her first meal for Matthew. And her dilemma is what to feed a vampire for dinner. She researches raw food recipes. And this is when she's at the library and she forgets her manuscripts completely. You could tell she was distracted. And she didn't know if he was truly omnivorous, as he said he was. But she did think he'd eat anything she put in front of him because he was such a gentleman. So that same day, Matthew had taken over the guard duty in the library, and there was no sign of Peter Knox or Gillian Chamberlain. Hallelujah. And Matthew seemed in good spirits. So she was looking forward to the meal. She was prepping, and Matthew didn't seem like having, at least at that point, like he was in any kind of black mood or anything. She leaves the library and does a little shopping.
She should have gone clothes shopping, too, while she was at it. I can tell you that. I mean, do I wear these black pants or these black pants? And this, oh, this one has a stain on it. And this one, just get some clothes, girl.
Well, we get a little hint about her, the meals, what the courses will be. She picks up some fresh venison and rabbit and then some Scottish salmon. And then she wonders if vampires ate greens. So ever the diligent student and researcher, Diana contacts the zoology department and asks about the feeding habits of wolves. She asks about gray wolves specifically, since it was what she was familiar with and it was Matthew's favorite color, gray. She found out that gray wolves...
That's not very scientific at all. I remember when I read that, I was just like, okay, that's like picking a football team because of the color of their jersey.
I know, huh?
Yes.
She did find out, though, that gray wolves ate nuts, seeds, and berries.
Like I said, nuts!
And the voice on the other end of the phone warned her, though, but you shouldn't feed them. They're not house pets. Because she'd asked about gray wolves. What do they eat? So, yeah, don't worry. Diana's not going to actually bring home any actual wolf. So she's going to pick up something a little more dangerous.
Well, she invited a wolf. Yeah, really.
That is true. So she picks up also some black currants, wild strawberries, and chestnuts. She picks up some French and German bottles of wine as well. And we're told that they're quite expensive. But we're not told quite yet what they are. Back at her rooms, she began prepping for the evening, setting the scene, moving furniture, setting the table, and she started making dinner and then realized that the cooking wouldn't actually take all that long. So she's like, look, okay, sit it down now. I better like back it up a bit because it's, you know, there's only so much to do and I can't do it too soon. By 7, it was time for her to actually prep herself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Deb writes, quote, I think this is what Candida was talking about. It was very funny. Deb writes, quote, my wardrobe contained precious little that said dinner with a vampire, unquote. She decides on a pair of swishy black trousers and a dramatic blouse of midnight blue. Quote, it had a funny collar that stood up in the back and winged toward my face before descending into a V-shaped neckline. The arms were relatively snug and ended in long, stiff cuffs that flared out slightly and ended up somewhere around the middle of the back of my hand, unquote.
Yeah, I just, even though she goes into such detail about what this shirt looks like and how it fits her, I cannot imagine what the hell it looks like on her.
You know what? I got the, okay, first of all, it's midnight blue, so the color is very dramatic. Mm-hmm. I don't know how like it fits, or it doesn't say if it's tight or too big or anything like that.
Just the arms, right.
Yeah, well, and the neck. The neck goes up like an Elvis collar.
That's what I thought, and I remember, and I was reading it, and I was thinking, that does not sound like a very attractive shirt. I'm sorry, Deb, but I'm like, is it the only thing that's clean?
No, but it's dramatic.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, it is the only thing that's clean.
But it makes it almost sound like she's wearing a vampire cape to have dinner with a vampire.
Which I just thought exactly. As I was reading, I just thought, that just sounds so weird.
You know, now that Summer said Dinner with a Vampire, another possible title could be Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, because that's too obvious.
No, because they go back and forth. So she tops it off with silver earrings. And her hair is shoulder length and straw colored. She pulls it back and twists it into a knot. And Deb goes to a lot of detail about telling us that her mother's face stared back at her. She has not a prominent nose and chin, not that they're huge, but that they're dramatic. And I think they're not overly pointy, but they are somewhat sharp. She has her mother's face. We're told a few times, but here, her hair is typically in her eyes or in her face, and she pulls it back. And she said it gave the illusion of cheekbones. Matthew arrives on time, of course. Deb's description, quote, when I pulled the door open, Matthew stood outside looking like the prince in a fairy tale, tall and straight.
As opposed to short and homosexual?
Summer.
Tall and straight.
In a break with his usual habits, he wore unadulterated black, which only made him look more striking and more like a vampire, unquote.
You know, the paragraph just before that, she says, you know, my chest fluttered at the sound as if this were a date, and she quashes the thought immediately. So, yeah, I mean, I know the answer to this, I guess, but I'm just going to say it out loud. Like, if the question is, she's quashing the idea of this being a date because he's a vampire and she's a witch, when there's obviously some attraction there, but she's telling herself, I can't act on that, or maybe, or is it she's just being a typical woman thinking he's not interested in me that way? You know, she's just saying, I squash the thought immediately, and I'm like, what for? Let's go for it. And, you know, and we know how the date ends, so.
I can go with that. I agree. So she does invite him in, but she's a little bit hesitant and actually asks him if she has to give him a formal invitation. That's what I love about this chapter, is both witches and vampires, although obviously for the most part, it's more vampire than witch. We learn about, okay, this, I just thought of a good way to frame it. Yes, he goes about dispelling the myths or legends that humans have and that witches have about vampires, and saying, okay, you know, what's true, what's not true. And then there's actually some truth to most legends out there, or they wouldn't have gotten started. So something has to have been, or is usually typically based on some kind of fact. You just have to kind of weed it out and find out what's true. What Deb is doing here is, yes, she's giving us information. This is Deb's world building. She's telling us that her vampires are not Hollywood. They're not sparkly. They're this. And so we're learning what her vampires are. She is defining how she chose to represent this mythical
species, this mythical creature, and demons and witches. So not only is it information dense that it is like so much description and this and the food and the knowledge and how old he is, and it's so many facets, but it's so rich, and it's pure world building. And I that just hit me tonight as we're speaking. Matthew tells her, forget most of what you knew and what you learned about vampires through folklore and most especially from other witches. And he brings her flowers. He brings her white roses. Now, no, those of you who have listened to our Outlander podcast, no, I did not do research. I mean, that might be pretty well known folk symbology, but or folklore knowledge. But I did not look up the flower.
But I wonder, here's the thing. Usually the red roses are, you know, love oriented, right? But I wonder if it was a double reason he didn't choose red roses. One, he didn't want to make it look like it was more than it maybe was, because he didn't know what she wanted. And also because roses are red and so is blood, that maybe he was like, I didn't want her to think that I was bringing something that would remind me of blood to dinner.
Well, incidentally, white roses are a sign of purity or innocence.
And she asks him if he's hungry, and he says, I could eat. Which I love, because it reminds me of something a UK, a Scottish or English friend of mine would say. If you're like, you're hungry, and then if they don't say like, yeah, I'm a little peckish, they could say, yeah, I could eat. Like, I could do with having some food. It's obvious. It's a way of saying, yeah, I'm hungry. But it also could mean like, yeah, I can, maybe not quite the same as take it or leave it, but yeah, I could do with some of that.
Oh, you know what? I have another embarrassing question. This, when I say another, because I was embarrassed to ask about the wolves.
Oh gosh, don't be embarrassed.
So, yeah, no, I am really embarrassed to ask this one, actually. So he says, I could eat, the vampire said with a grin. So here's my question.
I'm afraid.
Where are his fangs?
Why are you embarrassed?
No, I mean, it's like, because, you know, on TV shows, they always magically come out, but I don't remember where.
Oh, I think he just has sharp teeth. I don't think he has fangs.
When I saw that with the grin, I'm like, is he grinning? And he's got some fangs sticking in his showing. That would turn me off, I gotta say.
That's true. It wouldn't be very sexy.
Well, then I would imagine if he had permanent fangs or fangs that popped out, he would definitely have not smiled a toothy smile, because that would have been predatory.
I don't mind the way some shows do it, but I don't know if you guys have ever seen True Blood.
I liked the show,
but I hate the way they did those fangs, especially with the sound. I just thought it was so corny. And
you mean like that little click?
Exactly. They're clicking into place. It was so dumb.
Oh gosh.
It was like a little,
I don't know. I just got used to it.
Their faces stayed human, but then you got the whole Buffy series and the Angel, where their faces transformed into
the
demon. And yes. Then their teeth came out. I don't know. I can't think of any other examples, but in Deb's world, he stays handsome. He doesn't have corny fangs coming out, but he's got sharp teeth. So he didn't have any point. He just kind of, when he bites somebody, he's basically just ripping into their neck with his regular teeth.
Yeah.
That's pleasant. Okay.
Well, if you remember, didn't every time that he's in the book, if I'm not mistaken, and like I said, it's been a while since I've read through it, but doesn't he like cut
his teeth?
Right. So he's got to have something. There's something sharp along there. You know, what is the difference? Yeah. I want to know what the difference is between his teeth and, you know, other people's teeth besides the sharpness.
And I don't know if it's symbolic to that he's cutting and not, you know, or maybe it's a gentlemanly thing. I'm not a heathen. I'm not going to rip you open. I'm just going to slice you or. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm assuming is he a blood bag drinker? It's been a while.
Is he a blood what?
A blood bag drinker? Like, do they?
Oh, you mean like Angel drinking from the glass all the time? I don't know.
Like, what's his supply? Do we know what his supply
like
is?
Like animals, remember? Like stags and things. Like when he was with Hamish, Okay.
Yeah, but Summer's saying, what does he do when he's at school? He's not going to go out and
he doesn't need it every day. I don't know what he keeps at home in his fridge is what you're thinking of, right? What is his private stash?
Right.
You're going to have these listeners listening to this right now screaming the answers at them.
So
the
bad.
Podcast.
Oh, it's so bad.
Like, why are these girls talking about it? They don't know the answers.
Diana busies herself with preparing the meal. The first course is smoked salmon with fresh dill and capers and gherkins. She brings the plates to them and then serves also the German Riesling. Now, Matthew smells the wine deeply and concentrates. And she's wondering how many sensory receptors vampires had in their olfactory bulbs as opposed to dogs. Here's another potential comparison to wolves.
Mm-hmm. Now, did anybody else get hungry as they were reading this chapter? I mean,
no.
I don't want to eat. I don't want to eat raw venison, but
I'm vegetarian, so everything made except for the berries. That was nice,
right?
But nothing sounds good to me. All sounds disgusting.
So as you're reading it, you're actually grossed out.
Kinda.
Okay.
Well, I don't particularly like raw food.
Right, that's what I mean. But
I don't like salmon.
Ah,
oh,
I don't like smoked
goodness
salmon.
Gracious!
So I was like, the first course, I was like, ugh. But I was like, I would eat the pickles. I'll take your gherkin.
Oh, that's true. I would do that.
That sounded really naughty.
Well, and this, I'll take your gherkin. I was gonna jump ahead just because we were talking about it. But like the second course, Diana tries to eat the same eats the food to the same rawness as Matthew, and then she realizes that mistake. So the third course, she ends up cooking it for herself a little more. And I'm like, really? You had to try eating it raw before you realized you should have cooked it a little more? But anyway, so back to the reason. There you go.
Ginger, yeah. When you said the German, you paused, and it sounded like you'd put a comma in there.
Like a man's
name.
And
I really wanted, the German Riesling. I really wanted his name to be Riesling.
He brought German.
Oh, Lord.
Just in case he didn't like she what
served,
she ate.
She
dinner.
Served the German Riesling.
She had two dinner companions that night. You guys just didn't know. Diana is defensive about the wine. Quote, I'm not responsible for the wine. The man at the wine store picked everything out, so if it's no good, it's not my fault, unquote. And I wrote, LOL, this is something I would say.
But then I would have followed it with, but if it's good, I paid for it.
No, you still paid for it.
I know, but if you really liked it, you know, it was all my idea because I paid for it. I would, you know. You should take credit for it if you liked it.
Matthew notices that Diana doesn't eat, quote, like an American. And I know exactly what he means. Did you guys understand this right away?
Yes.
No, what does he mean? How do they eat differently? How do people food?
He meant the way she holds her knife and fork. So when I was in high school taking German, that is my second language now, but it was my first foreign language that I took. Our teacher showed us how they ate. It's called continental style. And it's where Americans typically eat. When they cut something, they use the knife in the right hand, the fork in the left hand, and then they cut it. Then they put the knife down, switch the fork to the right hand, if you're right-handed. If you're left-handed, then it stays. Then you eat, use your fork to spear whatever you're going to eat, and then you eat. And then when you're done, you put the fork down. And when you when you go to cut again, you switch hands again and pick up the knife with your right hand. And, you know, growing up here, I did that for all of my childhood. And it's normal, right? We're used to that. But it's a lot of moving around. It's a lot of extra. And so when our German teacher showed us, she was not saying you guys have to eat like this. She was trying to, it was a cultural lesson. This is how they do it. And so if you're ever in Germany or if you're at a German restaurant and you want to, you know, have an experience or anywhere in Europe, actually, this is how they typically eat. And so it's just another thing you learn about the culture. And I was an exchange student, as Summer was. And then I went to school in Germany. I lived in Switzerland. I lived in Scotland and in different times, in different places. And so I was there enough. So whereas the first time I was over there, I'm sure I did it quote unquote correctly, but it didn't necessarily like seal in my mind or in my natural actions. But going back again and again, I think it was finally like, you know, I don't want to know. I know them both. I don't want to worry about which to use. I just use the one. And now I've completely gone over to continental style. That's just what I use now. It's my default.
I agree with you on the way and the holding of which hand holds what, and you keep them basically in your hands the whole time. Yes. I do that as well, but I don't pile the food up on the back of the fork, which she does. Because then they don't have to, they don't flip the fork back and forth. They just, they hold it the same way. They
as you cut it, you mean.
Shovel the food up on the
got
back.
Got it. That's funny. Ah, see, then that's one difference I would do. So I would turn the fork over like to hold something down, right? To spear it kind of, and then use the knife to cut it. And then I would keep the knife in my hand because I use the knife to then help me either hold the thing on the fork, or if I'm thinking a lot about salad, because you can spear some stuff, but you also use the knife to kind of help you get a garbanzo bean or whatever, like, or a tomato onto the fork. So you have like a little bit of righty on whenever you're eating, and then you put that in your mouth. If you do it the way I do it, and Summer just made it clear and that I do it differently, is I have the fork down as I cut. And then when I'm done, I keep the knife in my right hand, but I turn the fork over so it's normal side, whatever, up. After cutting, I use a knife to cut, kind of put stuff on the fork so it holds it. And then I eat it with it's like right side up, if you will. Whereas Diana, she cuts it the same way, but then she leaves it that way. She doesn't turn it over and eat it with the right, quote unquote, right side up.
Piles it up on the back of the fork.
So yeah, that is definitely a difference. I mean, I can try it, but with salad and stuff, it's hard because you got a spear. Oh my gosh.
It was funny when you... What you were saying, she puts the food, or she, you were talking about the back of the fork is, I'm such an idiot, as I was reading that, I was thinking, why? She's putting the food at the very back of the fork so that she has to stick more of the fork into her mouth. I'm like, that's so awkward. Oh, why would you do that?
I just imagine trying to eat peas on the back of a fork.
Seriously, or garbanzo beans, anything like that.
I think I do it both ways, the continental and the American way. It just kind of depends because I tend to do a lot of things with my left hand because I'm right. Because I am right-handed, I actually do things with my left hand because I'm constantly washing them. I do both.
Learning it was unnatural because you make... Your right hand is still the cutter. So that's like the, you know, if you're dominant, right hand dominant, it's not that bad. But then to try and eat with your left hand. And I mean, it's not impossible. It's just, it's a little more coordination than I didn't have, you know, between the ages of like 0 and 14. And I learned it since then, but.
You used a fork when you were 0?
Oh girl. Between birth and 14. Oh, stop. You know what I mean? So anyway, we will have a link in the show notes about continental style, American style, and this whole thing that we're talking about and that Diana is doing, continental style. And what this has reminded me of and what Candida has kind of talked about a tiny bit, but I'll name what it is, even though it's not exactly it. It makes me think of something called cross dominance, which is where you have, typically everyone has a dominant side, like you have a dominant hand, a dominant eye, a dominant foot, a dominant ear, all these things. And typically they're on the same side. So if you're right-handed, typically you're going to be dominant. Your dominant eye will be right. Your dominant hand or arm will be light. You know, you'll probably throw with your right hand as well as write with your right hand. If you want to listen in closely to something, you'll naturally kind of lean in with your right ear. It's very interesting. That's dominant or hemispheric dominance. Well, if you have part of you that say, I'm right-handed, I'm straight, true, and clear right-handed, my left hand handwriting is disgusting, basically. It's really bad. But when I shoot archery, I have to do left-handed. And I found that out the hard way by like almost crying for being so surprised and so frustrated. Like I'm looking at the target. I know my arrow is not perfect, but there's no reason I should be shooting like 5 feet to the left. Mm-hmm. I know I was looking at it, but it wasn't happening. I don't know what's going on. Finally, the teacher came over and looked at me and he's like, oh, you need to change. You either need to change eyes or you need to change hands. I'm like, excuse me, what? So naturally I'm right-handed. So I shoot with my right arm as anyone would, whether it's a gun or archery, arrows, anything, but I'm left-eyed. And so I chose to retrain my arm rather than my eye. So I shoot left-handed. I have never done a gun. If I ever do a gun, I don't know about that. That one I may want to do right-handed just because it's a little more, I don't know, that scares me a little bit more. But the reason...
You just miss a lot.
Oh, Lord. Well, hopefully...
Because you haven't trained your eye.
Well, thinking about in archery and not so much... Well, in shooting, if it's like, you know, game shooting or... Well, not like animal game, but like if you're doing it... Well, I guess that's the only way.
Clay shooting.
Yeah, clay shooting, or if you're like doing it at a range or something, you can do what you need to do. All you do is you close the non-dominant eye. But I was closing, and I was closing my non-dominant eye. But no one noticed that I was closing my right eye and shooting with my right hand. You need to have the same side of hand and eye to be able to actually have a chance to hit the target. And one easy way to look at this without ever having to go to a gun range or ever having to try to go to a range or take an archery class or a private instructor is to just get your camera. Because with our telephones, we don't really need to look. We look at our phones, right? We don't need to like hold something up to our face and squint. But pretend you had an old fashioned, as of like, I don't know, 7 years ago, camera in your hand. And you were going to, you know, close one eye and take a picture. Take that, pretend you had a camera, bring the camera up to your face, up to your eye. The eye, naturally, the eye that's looking through the camera, the other one that you're not using, will, you will close your eye naturally, typically. The eye that's open, that looks through the camera, is your dominant eye. Because it's what you do naturally. And it's also the same way I found out about my my dominant ear. Because no one ever tells you this stuff. And it's kind of like trivial, it's trivial pursuit or, you know, fun facts, knowledge is nothing you really need, but it's interesting to know about your own body. That's a big segue, but it's very interesting. I'll also give a link to an article or some articles about cross dominance if that interests you. Things like that interest me, where your brain is basically not consistent. So I'm all kinds of messed up, basically.
That explains a lot.
All right. That was a nice little look.
Pretend you were going to open a pickle jar. Mm-hmm. What hand would you use to open the jar and what hand would you use to hold it?
I will hold it with my left and do the top with my right.
Very good. Candida, what about you?
I would probably do the same, but I'll admit when I open the refrigerator, I don't always reach in with my right hand.
Well, that depends on maybe what side your the handle is. Yeah. If it's a left, if the handle's in there.
No. It's an armoire refrigerator. I'm saying when I open the refrigerator door, I'm not talking about which hand I use to open it. I'm saying when I reach into the refrigerator to take something out of it.
Yeah, but what we're saying is sometimes, like myself, if I use my left hand, because the door lever or the not the knob, what do you call it? The handle's on the right. So I use my left hand to open it so I can bring it across my body. My left hand necessarily is full because it has the door in it. It's not necessarily related to what hand you use to open the door. But a lot of times the hand you use to grab into the fridge is the hand that's free. So because of where the handle's at. So you're saying if it's open and you have both hands free, you'll use the non-dominant hand.
Right.
Well, so you and Summer both said, see, this is why I got some crazy cross dominance going on. I'm right-handed, but 100%, 100%, 100%. I hold it with my right hand and I twist it with my left. Dad does the same thing, if I'm not mistaken. So I might get my messed-upness from Dad.
He also says Eastern and Western, so I don't think you should try to model yourself after him.
I'm not trying to. I love my dad. Okay, so we learn more about vampires. They can eat most everything, but they don't really like it necessarily. It just doesn't do much for them, and it doesn't taste like much unless it's raw. Diana asks Matthew why he continues to ask her out to eat. Deb writes, quote, Matthew's eyes flicked over my cheeks, my eyes, and lingered on my mouth. It's easier to be around you when you're eating. The smell of cooked food nauseates me, unquote. I wrote, blink. I wouldn't know how to take that either, Diana.
How can the smell of pancakes make him sick?
Oh, Lord. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's funny. You would think that the more raw something is, the more, I'm just going to, you know, it would be more powerful, perhaps more flavorful. So you would almost think it'd be the opposite. Like it would, the more cooked it is, the less it would bother him because it's cooking all the flavor and all the smell out.
Yeah, that's true. Because remember he says that he can't really, it doesn't really taste like anything or let alone anything good to him unless it's raw.
Right. So there's taste and then there's smell. I can see him liking the rawness of the raw food.
I'm glad this kind of came up, where I'm glad we're kind of stopped here for a moment. So I was prepping for chapter 13. In chapter 13, there's a line in there or a discussion in there about, kind of fulfills this, his line, kind of opens that door to thinking about this. In the next chapter, we hear the actual explanation of why. So I'm not going to spoil that, it has to do with her smell.
Yeah.
The adrenaline. Yeah. It's okay. The adrenaline. We all know she has a lot of it.
Well, but there's tasting your food coming from a person, and then there's the, you know, food on your plate.
So he wants to be around her. I like you. And he is not saying this directly. He's saying this indirectly. I like you. You smell really good. I want to jump your bone / drink you, eat you.
Right.
it's hard for me to be around you and not be uncomfortable because I feel these things and I smell these things and I want mm-hmm. to do these things. But I like you also, and I want to be around you, but it's very hard. It's very challenging. So it's easier if the nausea overcomes anything that I would have by attraction to your blood, basically. So him being nauseated allows him to be in her presence, basically. Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay. Well, without being hungry, he can be in her presence. He just doesn't want to. I think that if he's hungry, then it like limits his time that he can be around her. But at the same time, he's so old, which, cat out of the bag, I know we're about to find out how old he is. He's managed to, he's learned how to manage, his instincts. Granted, if, I don't know, if there was somebody lying there and they were bleeding, I don't know what would happen. But he's mature enough that he can handle it. So maybe it's something about her. He doesn't need to be nauseated to be around other people. It's her.
Exactly. Because he probably is attracted in general to human blood. But he can be around other humans and not freak out.
Exactly. And he's attracted to her smell. But the fact that he's attracted to her sexually is like amping that up. So, talk about his own adrenaline, right?
That's made it a little bit clearer now, to me at least. So he says back to her, I thought you knew that about vampires, and that's why you invited me to dinner or for dinner. So she says she actually knows less about vamps than most humans do. For example, she had been told by her aunt Sarah that vampires consumed only blood because it's all they need to survive. So here's the beginning of the something. Thank you. The demystifying and debunking. Debunking the vampire myths and legends.
Well, they weren't exactly friendly with them. And if I believe it actually works in the vampire's favor to be outwardly as menacing as possible so that they're left alone.
Agreed.
Yeah, the more somebody knows about you, the more vulnerable you are. So.
And you find out more about that in chapter 13 and what the state of the balance of the population of the world is, creatures to humans. It's kind of scary. So it becomes even more understandable why the legends came about and then actually protected them, even if they're false. So she's nervous. She can tell that she's making him angry, or at least a little bit
frosty.
Kind of, not.
Frosty.
Deb sprinkles some very human thoughts into the scenes. It's very lovely. Quote, nervously, I wrapped my legs around the base of the chair and realized I'd never put on any shoes. I was entertaining in bare feet, unquote.
She's like, he's not a vampire with a foot fetish.
Oh, Lord. Oh, like the Outlander. I was about to say.
You visit
us on all
I'm
the foot fetish
I'm mixing my books
episodes.
Up.
No, but you visit us on all the foot fetish episodes.
Yeah, what's the deal?
Look, you choose the chapters, not me. He further clarifies, he can drink wink.
What?
Speaking of it, I'm not
sounds
drinking.
Sounds like somebody over there is drinking.
I know. He can drink wine. He can drink wine and eat food, preferably uncooked. He's patient with Diana, but she can tell, as I said before, he's a bit frustrated, and she gives him more to drink. There you go. Always give him more drink. Yeah.
Here's the question. He can cook. He can eat uncooked food, but does he? I don't see him whipping himself up some raw salmon when he's home. When he's just home, like you were saying, right? Like you were asking earlier.
What's his stash? Yeah.
Yeah. What does he eat? So, when does he eat? Does he just eat around maybe Hamish or, I don't think he doesn't eat with humans.
I don't know about his home, but okay, for example, and I'm getting way ahead of myself, but when he goes to a certain place in France and hangs out with a certain lady woman, they hunt. But here in the middle of London or in Oxford, there's probably not a lot of places to hunt, right? Really close, and you're you don't have time to leave. When he went to see Hamish, he had land and opportunity and time to go hunt. Here, it's not that really opportunity. You're spending, hours in the lab, you're going home for whatever, a stash at home of something.
When he goes hunting, does he eats the kill? He eats the meat of the kill.
No. I think he drinks the blood.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. He's saying
but
he
can eat food.
But
then why waste the fresh meat?
So when was the last time he had a meal? Was it 200 years ago? Or
Probably during Elizabethan. Probably Elizabethan period was known, well known. Or something, yeah. More humanness. As Diana tries to pour him more wine, she almost sets her shirt afire. And Matthew takes over.
That's Mrs. Doubtfire thing to do.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh. Lisa, like, yeah, like they're fake.
Ooh, yeah. You just see her.
From Matthew, we find out he tells her, of course, most of what you know about vampires was dreamed up by humans. These legends made it possible for humans to live around them. And that kind of goes to what I said. It was allowing humans to do the living, but also, thus, if humans can do the living around them and they feel safe, it also, by default, makes the vampires safer because the humans are not going to go out of their way to walk that boat. So it's even though it was self-protective, kind of, for humans because they were, well, he just said it allows them to exist around them and kind of feel that they had some control or at least knowledge of these beings. It allowed the vampires, if not to thrive, to be in that. It gave them a place. It was a wonderful place, but maybe not. Maybe it kind of pushed them into the shadows. But again, in the next chapter, we learn much more about the balance of population, and that's important, but we'll get to that next chapter. So creatures, which are the vampires, the witches, and the wardrobes. I'm just kidding. The demons. Frighten humans. So those are the creatures. It's not just the vampires. And Diana concurs. For witches, she says, it's, quote, black hats, bats, and brooms, unquote. But it's based on some kernel of truth.
I have a pronunciation question. I have not listened to the audio version of this yet, although it was gifted to me, and Jennifer has the most beautiful voice. I'm just curious as to how demons is pronounced on the audio version. Is it demons or, you know, because of the way it's spelled in the book with a D-A-E, is it, they don't do anything weird like daemons or something, do they?
No, I'm pretty sure it's demons because I listened to it today. Yeah. And yesterday.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. No, me too. Because when I'm not listening to it and I haven't heard it like in say a week or a month or even a few months, it's not actively in my mind how it's pronounced. And then when I go to read it without the audio, my brain fills it in, or say like I read even the words spelt that way, my brain fights. Like I want to say daemons because that's in Latin, the AE combo is eh. And in German, the way that they would transcribe the A umlaut or the E sound would be AE. So that's what my brain is fighting like three different languages of not how to pronounce that. So
right. Brings me to my next point. I love that you put chapters 12 and 13 together because they really do piggyback together really well, because this chapter, of course, is all about the legend and mythology of the species, right? And then the next chapter is all about the science, which is just great to look at them from these two different perspectives. But one of the things, you know, in this world building that Deb has done, probably vampires are the most well known as far because they have so many rules attached to them more than, you know, than say a witch. But I like with the demons what she's done with them, because demons are like, whenever you see demons in a movie or any other like a television show, or I don't think I've ever read a book actually that had any demons in it, because I don't read those kinds of books. I think of them more as just these evil creatures, right? But she's given them this she's made them, one of the characteristics of a demon is, you know, is a geniusness, or that as she says here, they're awe inspiring creativity. Mm-hmm. Which I thought it was very interesting that she associated those characteristics with them. I mean, she made them more of a positive being than you know, these scary negative. Even though you can have good vampires, bad vampires, and witches and all of that. But I think that's one of the things that I really liked in this storyline about what she did with the demons. And it's unfortunate that, or I say unfortunate, but, you know, the two main creatures in the book are vampires and witches.
Are you calling for a side story about maybe starring some demon?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, but you know, if she had made demons bigger, then it would have, you know,
taken away from our
story. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm okay with that. But
what you say reminds me of something I heard. I listened to a TED. This is, oh gosh, a number of years ago, and it kind of like rocked my world and like blew my mind open. Because I didn't know that. I didn't know this. You know, because God forbid, I think I know much. I don't. Saw Elizabeth Gilbert, who gave TED Talk, and she was talking about inspiration and genius and muse, the muse. And she said that it is only in the last like maybe not even maybe around the Age of Enlightenment, so in modern times, or maybe a little bit later. All throughout history, whenever there's someone who's been incredibly gifted, especially artistically gifted, right, with music or art or whatever, any kind of inspirational kind of thing, writers. Yes, they've been praised for it, and they've gotten accolades and everything. But their mm-hmm. inspiration, if you will, their like writers having inspiration to write or not having writer's block. You know, composers or painters being inspired to produce the next great work. They never, throughout most of history, recorded history, they never owned their gift. Their gift or their inspiration, their talent came from some muse. It was from something outside of them that they kind of channeled. And around the time of the Enlightenment, we started to, as we distanced ourselves, you know, became more scientific and more rational and all things, we distanced ourselves from the idea of this muse, the idea of having inspiration, and, you know, and it was purely talent that only existed within me and it wasn't connected to anything else. And one of the problems with that is that then you are responsible for mm-hmm. not only your greatness, but also your failure. And so you have to take the good with the bad if you cut yourself off from this external kind of inspiration, kind of whatever muse thing. And she said how sad it is that we want to own this, right? We want to take full ownership and say, you know, this is me. I did this. Well, we really didn't. You were born with a gift and you have... whether you believe in God or not, or believe in a being, whatever it is, if nothing else, you know, you have genetics to thank, right? If it's something that you're born with, fair enough, but you didn't do anything to deserve it. You have it. However you got it, you have it, right? You can benefit from it. Absolutely. But to say it's 100% yours and to not be connected with like a deeper thing, whatever that is, or something outside of yourself, means you have no fountain to draw from. You have no, you know what I'm saying? There's nothing you're connected to because it's all within you and your body and your mind. So when we were disconnected as a species, basically from this well or from this muse, this muse who came and visited at certain times or whatever. And I don't mean like ghosts. I just mean kind of in a metaphoric sense. We benefit from having these great, great successes, but when something bad happens, like we have writer's block or we have, you know, we don't write the best piece or we can't compose a piece or aren't doing the next best painting that we have, like say it's been 5 years since we produced this beautiful work of art. It's our own fault. Not on purpose. Like we didn't do anything to cause it. Her TED talk was about seeing something bigger outside of ourselves. And I can't help but think of that when we think of the demons. Because they're so inspired, whether it's a mathematical genius, a musical genius, you know, they're some kind of genius. And they're also very, not emotionally unstable, but they can run to unstable. Anyway, it was fascinating. And we'll provide the link. It was gorgeous. That's what I think about when I think about the demons and how it's a beautiful, sad, bittersweet story about, I think, the demons. I would love to see a story starring a demon. That would be amazing. Deb writes, somewhere in each of these stories, there's a nugget of truth. Something that frightened humans and helped them deny we were real. The strongest distinguishing characteristic of humans is their power of denial. Let's ponder that for a moment. How many things in this world, in our human history, in today's world even, reflect this truism? So when humans see creatures in broad daylight, it makes them uncomfortable.
I feel the same way about
you. Don't know what they are. What? You have to see me in the cover of darkness?
When I... Ginger.
It's always to me. What are you
when
thinking
I see
about?
Her in daylight, I get uncomfortable.
It's because I blind her. If the sun doesn't blind her, I blind her more. So it's now time for the second course. Diana serves the raw venison with beets and Parmesan. And you know, except for the Parmesan, you couldn't make a worse meal. Well, I guess fish could be worse because I would never eat raw meat. I wouldn't eat meat, but beets make me I'll just tell you right now, since we learned about my my cross dominance, I'll just tell you. Beets make me barf.
Beef or barf.
Now y'all know way too much. Do you guys like beets?
I've never had beets.
Summer, you don't, right?
No. Never tried them.
Oh, okay.
They're real earthy. They're right up there with spinach for me. They both kind of taste like dirt.
Oh, I like spinach.
But I can handle spinach. Beets make me want to barf.
Oh, yeah, maybe I don't want to.
Oh, it's just me. But this is back when I was like 8. So I'm like scarred for life. I'll never do it again on purpose.
We'll try them now.
I'm very scarred. Oh, no. But even the smell makes me want to hurl. So the wine she serves with this course is red, and it was a côte rôtie. He can tell just by smelling it, and he even guesses the year. And Diana thinks, this is better than watching a game show. I could, like, line up the bottles of wine and blindfold this vampire, dude. He'd keep me interested all night, or entertained all night.
Yeah, that's what she's thinking about doing with him all night.
I know. Aww.
That's so sad.
Diana's been through some stuff.
That's so, some weird foreplay. Oh.
She is a tiny bit of a,
she's not a prude.
It's the opposite. She's not a prude. I don't want to call her a slut, but she's
sheltered.
She's not a slut, but she's casual.
That's true. You're right. You're right. Because we learn about her. She's not.
Yeah.
You're right. Mm-hmm. She's not uptight at all. She's had relationships.
Right.
As a matter of fact, later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but.
Well. Short term.
Oh well.
Short term relationships. Yeah. They lost a couple of hours.
You're right. You're right.
Or one night.
He says he can smell the fields. I mean, come on. It's hopeless for the rest of us if this vampire can, like, even smell the fields that the grapes were grown in.
Well, I think it's a multiple reasons why.
Yeah.
Because he's been to the fields, so it's a sense memory for him that he can, that drinking the wine, he remembers the fields. Because he's been there and he's had the wine before. So drinking the wine gives him the sense memory of being in the fields.
Right. Like I was saying, that Matthew in this chapter transports us several times. So
So he tells her that he remembers the first time he smelled chocolate, and he drank it too. But the first time he smelled chocolate in Paris in 1615, and he was in Paris. And we learn about more vampire lore, the debunking of these myths. No, they can't fly, but they are strong and they can run and jump. And that's decent, and he says that's probably what causes humans to think they can fly, because they can jump really high or jump really strongly. And also they're efficient, which is the kernel of truth to vampires being dead, right? Vampires being cold, vampires' heartbeats not beating that much. They only beat once in a while. Them not needing to breathe a lot, not needing a lot of oxygen, because the stuff that they do have, their bodies are very efficient at it. And so it may make them appear to not have really strong vital signs. And then we go to the third course, which is the main dish. This time,
how was the bleeding venison not the main dish?
Oh, because it was the second course. I know.
That was the second course, yeah.
So, maybe, because I think that, I think they're all pretty small.
Maybe it had to do with portion size.
Tartar, like venison tartar, like chopped in on a biscuit or
on a biscuit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, now I do like tartar. Now I want that.
So she seared some rabbit with rosemary and pepper, along with a type of chestnut biscuit. Now, this is the one thing besides the berries and the whatever at the end that I actually wanted to try. And it might even taste nasty. I would put probably some like Parmesan with it or something. But the chestnut biscuit sounded interesting.
That does not sound good to me at all.
I mean, you'd have to cook the heck out of the chestnuts to get, I'm not a cook. I'm not a chef. I don't know much about these things. So if I'm totally talking about doing something to a certain ingredient that is just not possible to do without killing it, I claim ignorance right now. But I could imagine, I don't know how she did it, but do you like bake until it's soft and then you like dice it up? And then she used some baking powder. So there was some stuff I probably used a little bit of flour to like hold the stuff together. But the chestnuts, I guess, olive oil would be so fat that would help hold it together. And then baking powder. And Matthew's like, not just that. I also taste salt, water, rosemary, and pepper. She's like, look, bitch.
So show off. So here's the thing.
I know.
Cooking with nuts as your grain is not that difficult. And I'm as long as you have a food processor. Because I can make my own almond flour with almonds. And there's many things that are made with almond flour. But yeah, so I imagine you grind it, the nuts, once they're roasted or however you're going to do it, into a flour. And then you just, whatever your binding is, and then you bake them.
That's true. See, I could imagine doing that because I'm saying, I may not do it. I could imagine doing it though. But what I'm saying is I could imagine eating that because it's obviously, and there's like no meat, let alone raw meat or rare almost rare meat. But it sounded interesting. Like chestnuts, I can kind of take them or leave them. But it sounded interesting. Like I might even do, rather than chestnuts, that sound interesting, I would use like hazelnuts. That sounds better to me. Maybe
I
not
think
with
that
this.
The problem with that recipe, it's a very savory biscuit. And hazelnuts are not typically savory. They're usually kind of sweet. Mm-hmm. But I personally can't stand chestnuts. And I don't even know that I've ever eaten one. But the reason I don't like them is because when I lived in New York City, there was all the chestnut vendors on the street burning them all winter long, burning chestnuts. And I was like, that's what I associate it with.
Does it smell like ass? What does it smell like?
It smells not good.
It's foul.
It's not good.
I was like, I'm not going to say it, but it's not good. So those of you who love it, I will say this. When I visited, because I didn't live in New York, but I visited the first time in 1991. And it was during the week after Christmas. It was deep, deep winter. And so those vendors were everywhere. And I smelled it. And I literally, because we don't have them here. I'm like, what is that? And they're like, oh, those are the roasted chestnuts. I'm like, oh my God, barf. Well, I never tried them. I wasn't interested after smelling them. But I wasn't around. I didn't grow up with it. So it was an acquired smell. And it wasn't something that I... you know, really liked. But I will say, and no, I've never lived in New York. I've only been a few times, but I've smelled the smell enough now that I probably would not mind trying one, but the smell is not as vile to me as it was. I know that just like your sense of taste changes with age, your sense of smell can as well, too, as far as reacting to things or accepting new things. But yeah, I am there with, to someone who's never, I literally had never smelled it between the ages of, again, birth and... I was 15. I just aged myself. So there you go. Now I wouldn't choose to be around it, but it's interesting how, different things, you know, you don't want to smell. Like, anyway, back to beets. I don't want to go there. So I get it.
Oh my gosh. I've never had anything chestnut at all.
So while they relax and chat, she brings out the fourth course. Nuts. Cheese. But yes, cheese, berries, and roasted chestnuts. He easily cracks the chestnut shell with his hands. And I'm like, okay.
Off again.
Exactly. Like, what good, dude? You know you can snap her like a twig with one, maybe not a finger, but a hand. You don't need to show off. Come on, dude. She knows you're strong. We get it. She asks him what she smells like. Since he's shown off with everything that he can smell with the wines, she asks him what she smells like. And we get a deliciously long and very specific list, thanks to Deb. Quote, "You smell of willow sap and chamomile that's been crushed underfoot. There's honeysuckle and fallen oak leaves too, along with witch hazel blooming and the first narcissus of spring. And ancient things, whorehound, frankincense, lady's mantle, scents I thought I'd forgotten," unquote. When I said it was specific, not only was it like, you know, specific plants, right? Or specific herbs or whatever. He's like, you don't smell like chamomile. You smell like chamomile that's been crushed underfoot. You smell like oak leaves that have fallen. You smell like narcissus, but not the first, not the third, the first.
But if you think about it, she opened herself up to getting not a great answer. Like, you don't know what he could have said. You're like, oh, what do I smell like? He could have been like cow dung and a hint of bullfrog.
Where did bullfrog come in?
Yeah, why is there nothing stinky in here? Or maybe it's like, I don't know, does willow sap smell
good? Well, I mean, I don't know about willow, but sap is basically, I mean, that's what syrup is. So I could imagine sap being sweet.
And not all saps are sweet.
I'm not saying you want to drink it. Diana's words attribute magic to Matthew. Quote, "His eyes opened slowly, and I looked into their gray depths, afraid to breathe and break the spell his words had cast," unquote. He asks her the same. What does he smell like? She replies, quote, "Cinnamon and cloves. Sometimes I think you smell of carnations, not the kind in the florist shops, but the old-fashioned ones that grow in English cottage gardens," unquote. I think she feels, I'm being facetious here, but she feels she has to like do the throwdown to. She's like, no, 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 not just any old carnations. The kind you get on the corner of the street in the thing, in the thing, and around the third one to the right. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, so she kind of gives as good as she gets here. Not to the extent that he gives, but she does decently. And he agrees, quote, clove pinks, he replies, not bad for a witch, unquote. Diana tells him that she had researched what to serve gray wolves in order to help her with preparation of dinner. Matthew has also brought some wine. Surprise, surprise. When he pours it, it was syrupy and golden. To Diana, it smells of caramels and berries and tastes of apricots and vanilla custard. Deb's description of the wine dancing on her tongue is beautiful. Quote, it was like drinking magic, unquote. Now, this makes me want to drink that wine right now. I will say that. And I'm not like a wino or anything. I just, that sounds really good. And I'm kind of thirsty. And I know you shouldn't drink alcohol when you're actually thirsty. Matthew says that it was made from grapes picked a long time ago. And of course he had been there. He described it to her. It was 1811. He had purchased the bottle from a man named Antoine Marie, quote, as soon as he told me it was going to be extraordinary, unquote. And it was called Chateau Yquem. So Diana begins to put things together. He had chocolate in Paris in 1615, received a building permit from Henry VIII in 1536. Just how old was this vampire? Matthew is a bit frustrated. He damns Hamish Osborne for putting certain things or making him aware of certain things about this woman and his feelings for her. He's having a hard time finding the right thing to say. He draws his finger through the candle flame. It blisters and then it smooths out. In case the reader has forgotten that he's a creature that's not human, he heals instantaneously. So his story, he says, he believes his body is 37 years old, approximately. He was born around the time Clovis converted to Christianity. They didn't used to keep track of birthdays back then. So he says, quote, it's tidier to pick the date of 500 and be done with it, unquote. So there. Matthew was reborn a vampire in 537. He was more than 1,500 years old. What do you guys think about that? Could you imagine your date? I mean, I know this is like total fiction, but could you imagine dating someone like that? No pressure at all.
I want to know how you keep from being bored all that time. That's a long time.
How you don't commit suicide.
I know, just like, I mean, I think about people who live, you know, a normal human lifespan who were perhaps born in the late 19th century, and everything that they've seen with the Industrial Revolution and, you know, just all the changes that have been made. And, you know, there's changes being made in our lives too, but to us, it feels like it's not as big of a change as some of the things that happened 100 years ago. So to witness the changing world over 1500 years is just, I mean, it's not something I think I'd want to experience, but it's just amazing.
What about you, Sam? How would you feel, or would you want to even, if this were even possible, would you date someone who was 15 years old? 15 years
15
old?
Years old? No, that's maybe illegal. Not. That's illegal.
Would you date someone 15, Summer?
Oh, Lord.
Well, but what if he was a vampire? What if he was
a 15-year-old vampire?
A 15-year-old vampire.
That's so wrong. No, I'm sorry. A 1,500-year-old vampire. Summer, go ahead.
I mean, there's a lot of pressure there because he's probably been with a lot of women. And there's literally almost nothing that you could show him that's new.
Candida, I don't know if you said it and got ahead of yourself, but you were saying that Diana's relationships have been like, she's open, she's comfortable with things. So she's not a hood or anything, but she's comfortable with herself and sexuality, and she does it to make a connection.
No, I don't think she is making a connection. She's doing it for purely physical reasons. But I don't think she needs to make a connection with people to have sex with them. I think she makes connections through her. I'm just saying she doesn't need it for, you know, for that.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, but what I'm trying to encapsulate is she does not need long-term relationships to have connections or to have a good life. That's what I mean. Long-term relationships, sexual relationships. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think she has, I think it is, it's sad the way she sheltered herself.
Sure.
I don't want to say right or wrong because I don't want anybody in the audience thinking there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm saying I don't think she does have a full life because of the way that she's lived.
Well, okay. And so that's where I'm going. I'm not saying it's right or wrong either. I'm not saying that she shouldn't be so sheltered. I'm saying her history up until this point is not being in a ton of, you know, a long-term relationship is all I'm trying to say. Right. So if you look at that and you compare that to what we know, although I don't think we know it yet in the books, but I know I'm getting way ahead of myself. I thought it was an interesting juxtaposition that Diana, who is, you know, quite, she shelters herself. She, you know, keeps herself back from supposedly, practicing magic and all of this stuff. And part of that sheltering herself is to not get too personal. You can have a sexual connection, but not to open up too much, you know, to keep herself safe and guarded because of what she's been through, which we'll find out more about. And so she can have that connection, sexual or not, with someone, but she does not need, or at least she feels, or at least she hasn't put it into practice, this many long-term close intimate relationships with the opposite sex, at least, or even the same sex.
I don't think you want to have many long-term
close relationships. No, but what I'm saying is that's not her history. Whereas from what we know, and we don't know a lot yet from chapters 1 through 12, but from what we know in the future, maybe about Matthew, is he hasn't had a ton either, but the ones he's had have been much more long-term than hers.
He's 1500 years old.
I'm
not saying because he's so old.
I'm just saying.
No, but that's standard for, you know, vampires who's 100 years old, you know. They seem to, I mean, there almost seems to be a mating for life.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So exactly. Now, does it mean that she wouldn't do that if she, you know, didn't have to feel she had to check herself all the time? Who knows what her inclination would be? I don't think at this point she knows her inclination because she's so guarded. She's not allowing herself to be her true self, whoever that is. So I just thought it was an interesting point that you brought that up, because from what we do know in the future about Matthew, their backgrounds are completely absolutely. But at the same time, Matthew has also kept himself, because of things that have happened, kept himself away from many close relationships. He doesn't want to. Number one, I don't think he feels that moved all that often. Not that he's not attracted, not that he doesn't want their blood. That's different. Something has happened that we'll learn about, and he doesn't want that thing to take a chance to happen again. So he's kind of cutting himself off as well. So for both of them, it is like a shockeroo, and they're both having to readjust in this, I mean, dare I call it a courtship, in this wooing, in this whatever it is, in this dance. So Diana rightly thinks to herself that knowing events he'd lived through or seen, how would this necessarily help her know him better? It would be exactly that. She would know things that happened while he was around or things that he had seen, but it wouldn't necessarily give her any insight into him personally necessarily. She quotes Ben Jonson, quote, "He was not of an age, but for all time," unquote. And Matthew responds, quote, "With thee conversing, I forget all time," unquote. And that's Milton. Okay, so you got two, not literally magical, but two creatures who are not human. So two magical, legendary, whatever creatures. They're getting to know each other. They're bringing flowers. They're making all kinds of schmoozy eye contact. They're talking about what you smell like and what he smells like. She's cooking him dinner. I mean, all this stuff. And they start quoting beautiful writer's lines to each other. I mean, come on. If it wasn't a date, it's a date now. Come on. It's beautiful. Magic is in the air. Quote, "We look at each other for as long as we can stand it, working another fragile spell between us. I broke it," unquote. She asks him, quote, "What were you doing the fall of 1859, unquote. And boom, there you go. She smashed that moment. And of course, Matthew is suspicious immediately. He knows Peter Knox is somehow involved with this. Matthew had been at the Ashmolean Museum at that time. And of course, that's how Diana knows Peter Knox had told her to ask Matthew about that time. And Matthew had been reading around the same time a manuscript of Origin, of course, Origin of the Species by Darwin. Diana says, alchemy has nothing to do with evolution. You know, like, yo, what's up? What were you doing at Ashmolean if you're looking into Darwin? Now, this chapter, I've already said this, I'll say it. This is where I actually wrote it. This chapter is one of the very most information-dense chapters, but in order to start tracking things, let's go with it. Matthew outlines the beliefs of French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck that species descended from different ancestors and progressed independently. I will provide a link to that in the show notes. He links this, Matthew does, to what the alchemists believed. Quote, that the philosopher's stone was the elusive end product of natural transmutation of base metals into more exalted metals like copper, silver, and gold, unquote. So they discuss these differences. Diana considers magic. Quote, maybe Matthew was right and magic really was in everything. It was in Newton's theory of gravity and it might be in Darwin's theory of evolution too, unquote. So not only is Diana admitting to herself, or in the past few episodes, in the past few chapters, she's admitted to herself. I heard that summer. She admitted to herself that that she actually is not magic free. She actually is practicing magic and has been the whole time, just in a different way. Mm-hmm. She's now not only like opening herself up to the fact that she embodies magic, to whatever she allows her to admit to that what that is, she's now open to considering that magic is in many, many things, in theories, in design, in the universe, in ways that she had not considered before. Matthew's reason for coming to the Ashmolean Museum. He says, Darwin had explored the alchemical theory of transmutation through biology, and he remembered stories, Matthew did, about a mysterious book that explained the origin of the three species, demons, witches, and vampires, and that it was suggested that this story was disguised from human eyes in a book of alchemy. He believed that if it existed, Elias Ashmol would have sniffed it out and bought it. Elias had the uncanny ability to find these types of things. So 150 years earlier, Matthew tells her, he had been looking for Ashmol 782, and he had been told that it was missing at that time. He'd been looking for it ever since. He'd been all over the world looking at alchemical manuscripts, and the only one in that entire time he hadn't seen was Ashmol 782. Therefore, quote, by process of elimination, it must be the manuscript that contains our story, unquote. So I know that was a lot, and we're not quite done, but I wanted to, for my own sake, rather than just spitting things out like evolution, transmutation, and biology, and magic, and gravity, all these different things, this book in so many places, in next to the next chapter too, no, it's so, I think the reason it's so information dense, besides I want to know the stuff that happened, and the world building, is Deb's also schooling us in science and in the history of science, because that's her area anyway. So in order for me, and if this is not something you guys, not you two, you two just have to live with it. If you, dear listener, if this is something that you find kind of that is bogged down, you know, feel free to skip a little bit ahead, like maybe a few minutes or a few seconds, and to see when our discussion of the science portion is kind of over with. But it's so important to visit, and it's not in every chapter, but this and the next chapter are some of the more science heavy ones or history heavy ones. And I think it's important to get it down, mm-hmm. because we do not have to revisit it. It may come up in like interesting conversation later on. But again, this is so educational, and I know a tiny bit about a tiny bit of stuff. Deb, of course, knows a crap ton. So she's introducing it to us in actually a very gentle way without saying, go read Origin, without saying, go read Lamarck, right? So I've tried to take what she put in the story and just kind of put it here through paraphrasing and through quotes. So we get more comparison of alchemy to evolution. Quote, what all the manuscripts I've seen have in common, though, is an absolute confidence that the alchemist can help one substance change into another, creating new forms of life, unquote, or evolution. So they take part two of the party, or their party, into the living room, for lack of a better term, this area where the sofas are, onto the sofas. He brings the wine with him.
And now it's a date.
I know, exactly. If you have two different rooms going on, yeah, if you've left the table, it's a date. And I wrote, darn if I'm not getting mental image. I didn't get this. When he came to the door, I didn't get this when they were making eye contact. I didn't get this when we're sitting around the table when he was eating. I only got it when they moved to the damn sofas. But as soon as they got to the damn sofas and she's all curled up and he's like sprawled out, kind of his long, lanky form, I got the mental image, darn it, of Richard Armitage. Because that's what That's what a lot of people are pushing.
You're going to be so disappointed if he doesn't get cast.
No, no, Summer. I'm not on the RA train. I just, I would appreciate it greatly, but I'm not preachy about anything. I just, it just popped in my brain, and that's weird because I don't have faces for any characters. So that was weird, but not unappreciated, Richard. She admits that she'd met, so she's like, okay, so we're being honest now, and we're drinking more wine, and we're in the second phase of this date, not date, and we're
Their body language was rather interesting.
Yes.
Especially hers. If she's attracted to him, why is she coiling away from him, basically? Mm-hmm. You know, or is she coiling away from him she's attracted to him, and she's such a floozy, she's afraid she's going to jump him.
Or is she like a snake where they coil, getting prepared to strike?
I just thought, this is her place, and she's the one who's like putting herself in the corner, and he's like taken over.
But he's that's pretty par for the course for Matthew. He does take up a lot of space, mm-hmm. not just physically, but personality wise, and.
Right.
Uh-huh. Even without meaning to, he enters a room and like empties it of everyone else.
Especially if she's there.
Well, he certainly his character in the first book anyway. Each of the three books, I love the way he changes. But in this first book, he's the top dog and he is afraid of no one. But here, the way she curls up, it almost makes, I just picture this as being kind of, I know she's not afraid of him, but at the same time, it's like, maybe she's not afraid of him, but is there something that she is afraid of such that her body is doing that, like curling up away from him and in like, you know, because when you think of the curling up, it's like, you know, you're protecting yourself, right? So I always, I just thought that was just fascinating the way they, when they moved, the way she recoiled away from him.
So they've been opening up little by little or lot by lot, however you look at it either way. And she thinks, okay, he's been honest and open and I can open up a little bit more too. And she tells him that she had met Agatha Wilson, a demon, at Blackwell's bookshop the week before. And she rehashes their conversation. And then she rehashes what Knox had told her about Ashmole 782 and how it was different. Demons, she says, believed it was the story of all origins, even human. Knox, on the other hand, so for witches, felt it was the first grimoire, the source of all the witches' power, and that it contained the secret of immortality and how to destroy vampires. And now it's Matthew's turn to give us the vampire version. Quote, "Vampires believe the lost manuscript explains our longevity and our strength. In the past, our fear was that this secret, if it fell into witches' hands, would lead to our extermination. Some fear that magic was involved in our making and that witches might find a way to reverse the magic and destroy us. It seems that that part of the legend might be true." Unquote. So an alchemy book that could hide secrets in plain sight. He says that they have to figure out what parts of the legends of the manuscript are true and which aren't. She confesses about Ashmole 782. She says, yes, it's an alchemy book on the surface. It's a palimpsest, but the ink hadn't been washed away. Magic was hiding in the text. He says it's okay for now for the mystery to remain buried. It might be better that way for the short term, but soon they will need the book. He tells her to come to his lab the next day so he can show her what he means. As he leaves, he notices her doorknob is a bit rattly and suggests she get it looked at. She sees an emotion flit across his face. Now, what did you guys think that Deb was hinting at? What emotion do you think? He's just told her that it looks like your doorknob is a little bit loose.
Or is the emotion related to the next line? I'm sorry the evening ended on such a serious note. Or is it a combination? I mean, why would there be an emotion? If he's worried that she's in danger, I guess concern mm-hmm. is an emotion. Or is concern an emotion? No, concern's not an emotion. What's an emotion? Worry. I'm not quite sure why she makes such a point of this when he detects the doorknob. Mm-hmm. And because he's already known.
He's just protective. It was a protective thing. I mean, I don't.
Right, but why make the big deal? We already know he's protective of us. We've gotten oodles of that in the library.
Yeah, it could be not directly because of the doorknob, but because of what the doorknob being like that might mean or might what it might lead to. It could be fear for her safety. So fear is an emotion. So there could be something that she's just not able to read. And oh my gosh, if this is, you know, if this door is not really working and someone is, because he's thinking, not because he's smarter, but because he knows a lot more of the danger she's actually in. He's thinking like 35 steps ahead of her. He knows she's in danger in this place.
Well, but we're also talking about supernatural beings.
Yeah.
And any one of them can come through this door. The lock is only going to keep humans out, for goodness sake.
Please, you know. He came in a window, like a mildly ajar window.
Exactly.
That door is not a problem for him.
A flimsy lock is not going to keep out a demon, a witch, or a vampire.
No.
Especially knowing that she doesn't have to invite the vampire in, you know, for them to come
in.
So I'm not sure why he's so much more concerned here, other than at the library, he feels like he can protect. He's, you know, somebody's always there to protect her, but when she's home, there's nobody. Maybe there's some that he doesn't think she knows the kind of danger that she's in yet. He's tried to instill that in her. He's tried to explain that to her, but he doesn't think that she quite gets it yet. And he will.
But she doesn't. None of us do yet. Like I think we all have like an inkling of it, but I don't think any of us has any idea exactly how much danger she's in.
Well, but not even going to, you know, even to the much, much later in the book. I mean, even just the danger right now, she's not in, you know, immediate danger. She's in a, obviously, I mean, there's not a threat that's going on, but there's a threatening feeling that's going on, because it's like, everybody's getting angsty. Antsy. And, you know, cause everybody wants that manuscript, and they're all just, there's the buzzers are circling, basically, is what I'm trying to get at. And he's taking it more seriously than she is, because he knows more than she does.
He is 1500 older. Years old.
Listen, I mean, not just because he's older, but because he hasn't denied who he is, and she has for all this time.
Well, and he also knows the players.
Right. Exactly.
So.
But but that doorknob, like I said, that's nothing. It's just, and the fact that it's loose, meaning somebody tried to break it. Are we supposed to expect that some witch was over there with a little lockpick set and they couldn't get through the door?
Lockpick set? They just need a screwdriver to take the knob off.
I know. It just that stupid door. Just I always thought seemed kind of silly, because it's just. It's not going to keep out the baddies that go after her. Spoiler.
All right, Ginger, wrap it up.
We get to the good part right here. Well, it's all good.
Slow motion continental kissing. Come on.
The
sexual person here.
Yeah, does she kiss like an American or a European?
He kisses like a Frenchman.
They kiss like a Frenchman. You beat me to it.
So, showing her human again, quote, "Was the dinner really all right? We talked about the secrets of the universe, but I was more worried about how his stomach was faring," unquote. And he replies, "It was more than all right." Before she knows what she's done, she doesn't even think about it. She kisses him. Doesn't she go like up on her toes? She kisses him on the cheek before he leaves. Yeah. And Deb writes, quote, "It was over in a matter of seconds, but as I knew from using magic to get notes and queries off the Bodleian's shelf, a few seconds was all it took to change her life." Unquote. Quote, "Matthew studied me when I showed no sign of hysteria or an inclination to make a run for it. He leaned toward me and kissed me slowly once, twice in the French manner. His face skimmed over mine, and he drank in my scent of willow sap and honeysuckle. When he straightened, Matthew's eyes looked smokier than usual. Good night, Diana, he said with a smile," unquote. And he leaves. So what I want to know, I'm not quite done, but what I want to know is, so you guys mentioned the kissing. To me, if someone says French style and she just went on his cheeks, I've never heard of anyone going 1-2 on the lips. To me, it was on either side of, it was on both of her cheeks.
It was on her cheeks.
That's what I thought. Yes, okay.
That's the French way.
That's not like, just French, it's German.
I know. It felt like it was a one-upper. Like, she kissed his one cheek and then he's like, oh yeah, I can do that. But it's like part of me's wondering is like, was he waiting for her to like try to one-up him again? Like it was becoming like a one-upping thing.
I think he felt safe doing that because it's so funny that she had Deb had to write about poor Diana. When I showed no sign of hysteria or an inclination to make a run for it. I mean, she's been really like she's ditched places before. She's made it very clear that she's, you know, not. I mean, she's like queen of the adrenaline here. She is easily anxious, easily scared off. She's always ready in that. She's always in that, almost always in that flight or fight mode. So even if he wants to like jump her bones tonight, he knows that he needs to take it no matter what. Take it slowly.
You just said something that I've been biting my tongue on the whole time because I know we're going to talk about this in chapter 28, my other chapter. And that is the fact that Matthew is extremely patient. I mean, he's done it all. He's in no hurry to do, you know, to do anything.
About that, and we'll definitely have you act for chapter 28. But about that, I feel so bad for Diana because, holy crap, that girl. I mean, granted, we're not talking like 10 years she had to wait or anything, but. Holy shadokus. I mean,
she at least the way like it's a book written. And a half.
Oh, a book and a half. They said a not a book and a
no,
half.
No, she doesn't have to wait. You're right. He has to wait.
They both
wait.
Well,
no,
you're right.
They both wait.
Yeah, they don't wait.
Oh. I think he might have been there for her a couple times.
I see what you're saying.
I'm so
ladies
forgetful.
First.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, exactly. And after he leaves, she turns around and she sees, we're reminded of life outside of the cocoon of the two of them.
Matthew Diana bubble.
There's a blinking light on her answering machine and it's a message from her Aunt Sarah. She already knows this, but she didn't want to talk to her Aunt Sarah or have to answer the same question she'd have asked herself. And that is
chapter 12.
The end of my notes, certainly. So this was a really rich chapter, not just in like the smells and the food and the science and the history, whatever, like the world building, but a lot of ginger.
Ginger, that's the nature of most of our podcasts.
No, but not like this. No, really, it's just me reading, me reading my notes. This was like me reading my notes plus like having two or three tangents that were like 10 minutes long.
I mean, feel free to edit those down.
Anyway, so thank you, Candida, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was a great, as always. Great chapter.
So with Candida, it's either sex or foot fetishes now, right?
Or food.
Or food. That's true.
Wine.
Well, kissing is physical. It counts under sex, and then food, wine counts under food, I guess. So food, feet, or sex.
This was romance. Well, this was a romantic chapter.
Oh no. Well, this was, yeah. 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 I just meant that your topics.
Hey, okay, Sammy. Everyone's version of romance is different from everyone else's.
That is true.
Some people it's foot fetishes. Some people it's eating. Some people it's, you know, long, longing looks. Some people it's coiling away from somebody else on the couch.
Well, this was a great combination of things in this chapter, which is probably what makes it so interesting to me and to everybody else, I guess. As well as the next chapter, plus with the introduction of Marcus, which I'm excited because I love his character.
All right, so join us next time when we discuss chapter 13.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. You can find our audio channel at www.audioboom.com/channel/AllSoulsPod. Many thanks to Penguin Audio and Recorded Books for allowing us to use portions of the audiobooks in our show. Visit our website at www.allsoulspod.com. Follow us on Twitter at All Souls Pod. Find us on Facebook by searching for The All Souls Podcast, or email us at allsoulspod@gmail.com.